The what?
What about the time that they had the wine cakes up in the shelter deck, and they were working in the lower hole, and one of the longshoremen went up and pounded a nail in that keg. He put the nail in, then whenever the water can got dry, he could go up there and let that nail, that wine, run in the water can.
Now, we had a guy that used to call him the professor, and he was the guy that used the insurance to its maximum. He was always faking something or another, you know. But well, anyway, one time, and this was in the olden days, they used to have a coal bunker over there.
Right.
And well, anyway, this coal used to come down the chute. And one time he was down there, they was leveling off the coal, I guess, and small chunk come down, hit him in the head, real small. And so Red Schwartz, he went over to him, and he told him, he says, "God damn," he says, "you got a suitcase in your hands there, man." He says, "God damn, this could affect you the rest of your life." And by that, so lo and behold, he got to thinking about that. So when he went uptown, why, he was waiting for a bus, and there was this policeman standing there. So the professor went into his dance. He walked around that cop, just right around the circle, like a merry-go-round, was mumbling and talking to himself. By God, the old cop, he called the wagon. So they put him in a padded cell up there. Well, as a result of that, he collected on the insurance, and he had a real good case, because he had a fine witness in that cop, you know, so he had a real good case. So he collected $1,750 out of that, which wasn't, that was a lot of money in those days, that was a year's salary. But anyway, and again, one time he was down the hole, and Red was, Schwartz again, was talking with him, and one of the professors, one of his virtues was that he wasn't the most modest man that ever lived. So the professor, Red told the professor, "You're pretty good at mathematics." Now he says, "I wonder if you could figure this problem out for me." "Oh yes." Well, he says, if an ounce of coal is worth $1,750, how much is a ton worth? But One other time, you know, the professor always visualized himself as quite a musician with a violin. And so this was strictly a con job up in the saloon there in Old Town. Why, they had a contest between the professor and, I forget what the other guy's name was. But anyway, it was to decide who was the greatest musician of the two of them. And so the professor, he'd play a goddamn old tune there, you know, and when he got all done, why, you could cut the silence with a knife. When this, I think the guy's name was Joe, and Joe got up there, he couldn't play where sour owl shit, but he got up there, and whatever he started in, it always wound up as old Black Joe. And when he got done, why, everybody was just applaud to beat hell. Oh, they thought that was wonderful. Well, anyway, this went on for quite a while. Finally, the professor, he'd just give up in disgust and walked off. But strictly a con job. But one other time, somebody called him up, and I don't know who it was. It could have been Casey, but they called up the professor, and they asked him if he was a musician. "Oh, yes." Well, they told him, "Well, we're having a party. This is an old Finnish party. Do you know any Finnish?" Said, "Like, oh yes," and "well, we're having this party on such and such a day, and we want a musician of your caliber. Understand, you're a fine musician, and what we want you to do is we want you to get all dressed up, and at a given time, at 9 o'clock, we want you to get your violin and walk up to this door and open the door and come in and start playing." Which he did. He went up to this play. He was dressed like a Mormon preacher. And he walked up there. He never even docked. He looked the address. Walked in that thing. And he started in the playing. And of course, everybody in there was mortified, you know. I held a professor in there because strictly a con job. Somebody had found out they was having this party. So they, and they had promised him, I think, $75 for this thing. Well, he pretty near wound up in jail there because he insisted on getting paid for this goddamn performance. And of course, he stunk up the joint with his goddamn selections. And so I guess it finally dawned on him they was pulling his leg. But that was a stunt they pulled on the professor. But he was quite a guy. I first got on the waterfront. He was on one of his insurance cases. He hadn't been working in for a couple of years, and it wasn't one case; it was another one. And I think he finally didn't get hurt pretty bad on one of them. But there was all kinds of things that went on, and the one I liked about as good as any of them probably was one of Sailor Petrosky's stories. And Sailor, he was a kind of a legendary figure on the waterfront. But anyway, he was a checker down to Sperry Dock, and Ed Vincent was the foreman down there. And this particular given day, there was a bunch of celebrities from the General Mills head office, the president, and he had a bunch of customers apparently with him, and they was surveying the warehouse, you know, and they had quite a performance there. Well, anyway, they noticed all these sacks was marked Point Arenas, so they wouldn't know where Point Arenas was. They didn't know. Well, they went to the foreman, Ed Vincent, asked him where Point Arenas was. He says, I don't know. He says, I'll tell you one man that does know, that's Sailor Petrosky. So Sailor's out there checking cargo right in the aisleway there, and Ed hollered up to him and to the Sailor, and he says, "Hey, Sailor, where in the hell is Point Arenas?" Sailor says, "All over the goddamn warehouse."
That is funny.
Yeah, there's all kinds of peculiar stories about the waterfront.
Did anybody mention the time that they were clamming sulfur down at Schaefer Dock? And I don't know whether they came back for lunch. And they started clamming away. Pretty soon you see a streak out in the on the water. Sulfur. The government looking, there's no barge there to clam the sulfur in.
They hadn't even looked.
Oh, there used to be some awful ones.
Were there any of not the foremen so much, but of the employers of the various stevedoring companies that the men considered harder to work for or less desired?
There's always that, wherever you go. Mm-hmm. There's the slave driver, the guy that can get the work out of you and make you like it, and then there's the guy that tries to do the same thing but hasn't got the capabilities. That's the way they're
doing. What was the reputation of the people from Rothschild's in general?
Rothschild's, Tom Green didn't have too sensational reputation. He had some good men. Some of the men that, Oscar Hansen, for an example, there was a lot that didn't like him, and I really thought he was one of the most competent men that they had. One of the most competent. Some of the companies were easy to get along with, of course, was like Griffith and Sprague and so forth. They had a different type than the Rothschild. Rothschild probably had, as far as having the ones that were the least popular, probably Rothschild had them. Mm-hmm. But that didn't mean that they weren't good men. They could probably get more work out of the guy. In those days, you could crack the whip or can, you know, and which did happen occasionally. But of course, the guy that kept on canning gangs, he wouldn't last very long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're getting paid to load ships.
Matt, were both of you involved in the 71 strike? Were you still working during the 71 strike?
That to me wasn't a strike.
In what sense?
Well, you turned around and you worked your military cargoes, and it seemed to me like if they didn't have quite enough work on the military cargo, you'd come down here and you'd be sorting rubber or something of that nature.
That it wasn't really a serious effort to stop the work?
In my estimation, now that's my personal opinion, I figured when you get into the strike, you shut everything down. And maybe that's why it runs so long. They gave them too much leeway to get rid of some of the excess cargo and things. But I know I can read it. I think I came down here and they were sorting rubber one time, if I'm not mistaken. Do you remember?
Yeah.
But every morning you had a certain amount, they had the list, and you'd go to work on it. Well, I was painting my house, and after I got through painting the house, then I went down on the water dump. But before that, I finished the house up first.
Excuse me? So what did you see as the real issue in 71? I know the Steadyman thing was one of the things the newspaper talks about.
That was one of them, and that was the contract that they discontinued on the M&M. Now, whether that was a factor in that or not, I don't know. I can't say one way or the other.
How did people in Tacoma feel about the Steadyman thing?
Well, they never did care for the Steadyman. The only ones that they ever had steady around here was a crane driver at Pier 1 and somebody at Hammerschmidt Lumber here. That was taken care of by the longshoremen. The two hammerhead cranes, and then if they needed another crane once in a while, the guy from Pier 1, if there was nothing doing, would go over to Pier 2 when they had the cranes over there, but they usually hired the crane drivers then. But that's the only place they had steady men.
Well, the gear lockers, that's...
Well, the gear lockers had their steady men, but as far as the steady men here, you see, the steady men on the coast would work in the gear locker, work on gear or work on the crane if they were crane drivers or whatever they were. And that's where one bone of contention was in not staying with the job that they were hired for. They were doing other jobs in their spare time, and they didn't want the men... They figured that there was other men that could do that work. In other words, they wanted more men working instead of having a steady man. I think that steady men on the waterfront is the outside of the gear locker is detrimental to the waterfront, in my estimation.
Well, it cuts down the work opportunity, doesn't it? I mean, for...
Well, of course, there are some supervisory categories, like on the docks, where they probably have to have a supervisor. When I was a foreman, you had to do all the planning. You didn't have a supervisor to help you out. You took care of the warehouse and where you wanted it, and not where the supervisors wanted to put it or needed it. In other words, you were foreman of the whole works. You took care of the warehouse along with the men. Now the supervisor is the one that brings the cargo in. Then they got more checkers. You got more cargo, of course. But their complaint is that everybody can't be a supervisor, which is true enough. Because you can't take a green man and bring him in that hadn't been working on that dock and expect him to be able to spot his cargo where it's going to be the most convenient for the workers and to get rid of it. So But that was
the wasn't part of the steady man thing is the companies are somewhat reluctant to pay for the kind of training that would be necessary to make sure that every longshoreman's capable of every job.
Well, I don't think that there is a. Well, you get very few longshoremen that are capable of doing every job.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when it comes to a lot of paperwork. Some of them can and some can't. Then there are some of them that can do paperwork, but they aren't worth a darn as a longshoreman.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got others that never would be a darn either any place.
So you retired when, 74?
November 1st, 1974. I didn't wait for 8 months until the contract was up in 75.
Uh-huh.
I quit. I'd have got $50 more on the pension, but it would take me 15 years to make up for the... I'd be working for half pay there. See, I picked up... 8 months of 150, and I picked up 8 months Social Security. I'd have gotten more probably. When I quit, I quit.
I had it long enough.
I wasn't worried about that extra 8 months. There's always that chance that you would have got bumped off too. You never know.
Mm-hmm. So when did you retire? 76.
When does that go? I always was an advocate of retiring early retirement, so therefore I would have been a hypocrite if I didn't, and I'm not a hypocrite that way.
Mm-hmm.
I figure that as soon as you get out of there, there's soon somebody else can take a job.
Mm-hmm.
Needs some work.
Mm-hmm.
I put in my hitch. I never regretted it, I'll tell you that.
Well, it was hard work, but there must have been advantages to it as well.
It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. It was fun for some people and other people. It was manual labor, but I think that the lazier you are, the more, the harder the job is.
Mm-hmm.
The lazier you are, because a lazy man, the 8-hour day is a long, long, long day. An ambitious man, 8-hour day is a short day. It's that simple. And you show me a lazy man, and without exception, if he ain't lazy on the waterfront, he'd be lazy wherever he is. And that's always been my philosophy. So it was a lot of fun for me. I couldn't get a kick out of it. There was always some goddamn screwy incident that was going on. Hell, you'd think about it and laugh. Of course, I'd laugh even in my sleep thinking about some of them. One of the funniest, and there's a good many funny ones, but one of the funniest ones was involved not actually longshoremen, they were maintenance men. When they greased the blocks on a crane, they generally lower the boom. And they lower it down so that it's on the back end of another crane, so that the man doesn't have to climb out there in the boom, and he can just go up there and grease it and do whatever has to be done. So, so there was a maintenance man over there. He had a hearing aid, and he had a couple of ships shot out from under him during the war, and so he had a plate in his head, and he had bum hearing. Well, he was up there greasing the big block on the crane, and he went inside and done a little puttering around, and as he went by, he accidentally kicked the lever of the travel motor. The crane was traveling. And unbeknownst to him, he can't hear because he's shut off his hearing aid, irritated him. So the first he knew about it was he happened to walk outside and he seen the dock moving, They thought, holy God. And of course, by then, of course, the steel and the glass was flying in all directions, and he happened to run in there and he shut the thing off. But of course, by then, of course, most of the damage had been done. And this other guy had been hollering at him to stop, stop, stop. Well, that didn't do him any good. He could shout as loud as he wanted, but the guy couldn't hear him. That was really funny. Poor old Charlie, the last I seen him up there, he was sitting down on the steps of the opposite crane over there, and he had his hands and he had his head in his hands there, and he was just about ready to bawl, I think. Oh, he was sad over that thing, because there's nothing he'd do. It was really funny to me. But there was always something going on. There was always some excitement. Whatever.
In the early days, it was always hard work. Regardless of what predicament you got in, there was always somebody to help you out of it. And it was enjoyable. Mm-hmm. It was actually enjoyable working, even though it was hard.
Did you like it better? And you drove Strad towards the end, but when you started, you would work gangs and stuff. Did you prefer working gangs where you had guys right there with you rather than being sort of so high up off the ground with nobody to talk to?
Well, we had a radio in there.
So you could at least talk on the radio. Yeah.
No, I'll... It didn't bother me too much. It seemed like that's what I felt like I was capable of doing the best, and it was a challenge. Mm-hmm. It seemed to me like everything on the waterfront was a challenge, regardless of what it was. And if it was accomplished properly, I felt a certain satisfaction. The same thing with the gear lock. That was a challenge, because I didn't know nothing about gear.
That challenge is a bunch of bullshit.
Why do you say that, Lee?
Oh, for Christ's sake, you sound like some goddamn psychiatrist.
That's the way I feel.
Oh, well, I used to drive crane once in a while, you know. When you get to up there, you know, I never even had a radio, and I never paid any attention to them goddamn scales that they had up there. And about the only conversation I ever had was the deck man down below, or the hole man, when I could see him loading logs, and that would be, I'd tell him, get the hell out of the way. and they would, generally, too, because they know I was kind of a wild son of a bitch up there.
Now, you, Frank wasn't here, but you were here in the early 50s.
I was here in the 50s, yeah.
Now, when the ILA was expelled from the AF of L, what did you do in Tacoma, sort of, when you knew they were going to be expelled for the corruption and stuff?
Well, then
did it come as a surprise to you, or had you been planning in advance and you knew what you would do?
Everybody knew that there was corruption on the East Coast, but here it didn't make any difference what banner you was under. You was going to work the same as you always did, and you didn't have to pay anybody for your job or anything like that. And this, in New York, now, when I was in the Army, I had a gang, and I also had a New York longshoreman in there. And this New York longshoreman, as far as being a skilled man, he wasn't. His name was Pat Riley, and he's dead now. I won't go into that. So anyway, I used to talk with Pat about the conditions there. Well, when he was a ramrod there, he was not a deck man, but he was the kind of, you might as well say, the foreman of that particular gang. And it seemed to me there was right around 19 men involved there, which include backup men on the dock. And so as far as wages is concerned, that wasn't a big item with his, but he let me know real quick that when he had his vacation, it was up in the Adirondacks up there, and he showed me even pictures of where he vacationed. I said, geez, that's stepping pretty high there for a longshoreman, and he kind of looked at me as though to say, well, we get money other than from just our wages. He made that quite clear. And when he got back in the waterfront, his job was gone. Show you how they operate back there, whereas in the Tacoma here or any place else on the West Coast, you know, when you got back from the service, your job was there. same thing, whatever you want to be doing, but his wasn't. See, this is the difference. Mm-hmm. But they, from talking with Riley, it was corruption from one end to the other. It was rotten. It was absolutely rotten. And everybody had their hand in it. Now, a friend of mine, he drove a truck, and he brought a load of, a truck of eggs into the terminal in Brooklyn. And so when it come time to unload, and it come time to sign a bill of lading, there was one short on there. And he told him, he says, no, no, he says, oh, no, no, he says, no way, they got to come out even here. All the guys said, this is what we had, so we sign it. No, he wouldn't do it. And he finally found that, he went out looking, and he finally found that crate of eggs up on top of the office in the warehouse. But everything has always been altogether different on the East Coast and on the West Coast. You don't have to depend. There's a certain amount of skullduggery going on wherever you go, in business or labor, wherever you go. But there, that's real bad.
But you guys knew that they were going to be expelled, and...
Not necessarily. I suppose they suspected eventually that they would be,
How long was it after the expulsion that the new AFL...
The
union
IBL?
Was set up, yeah.
Oh, I don't know that. Tiny would probably come pretty close to knowing that.
But for the men in Tacoma, it didn't really make much difference. I mean, you sort of changed your name, but other than that...
Well, we kept our allegiance with the sailors. Now, the sailors actually contributed considerable probably during the 34 strike, and after that they contributed nothing as far as the waterfront is concerned, because all they ever did was do longshore work. You know, whenever the salt ships would come in, the Pioneer, any of them would come in here, they'd always have one hatch to work themselves. Or when the steam schooner was in. And they would always get by with murder. They would, they'd be able to land loads for a longshoreman, and the adjacent hatch would have to hand stow them, and things like this here. So we actually were contributing to their to that steam schooner agreement, and had we went with the coast right to start with, I think probably the steam schooner agreement would have went belly up. But actually, the steam schooner agreement, all it did was take work away from us. That's all it ever did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and. When it come to any manual labor, even in their hatches, why, the longshoremen have to go up and clean up and so forth. So it, and all we did was furnish the front men. So we were actually given longshore work away. And it was the same wherever you went. I found the same thing up in the service, same identical thing. I never will forget, I gotta tell you that. I was on, had a charge of unloading a ship, well, all except one hatch. And it was, I only had 10 deck men, so I was scattered out pretty thin. And so I had to discharge these LCMs, landing craft mechanized, they called them. I think they weighed about 38 tons, so you had to use a jumbo gear on it. Well, anyway, after I discharged them, then they had some smaller additions of them that were, well, they were about the same size, and they was, I had to snake them out from underneath the stays. Well, in order to do so, and they were in a cradle, in order to do so, I had to have blocks and so forth, and straps and so forth. Well, I went to the mate, and I went to the sailors. I tried, where in the hell's the blocks at? And nobody knew where the blocks were. I knew I had to have them. I said, okay. And so now I just disconnected the falls in number one hatch, and I put them around a cleat, and I used what is commonly known on the waterfront as an Oregon block. It isn't a block at all. All it is a ordinary cleat. And I used that, and of course, by the time I snaked up the boats from underneath them stays, why, them falls looked like they come out of a Timex watch that was all curly, see? Well, a mate come running up there and a screaming bloody murder, you know, and says, you can't do that. And I says, why in the hell can't I do it? Well, he says, you got to use blocks. I says, fine, where in the hell are the blocks at? I asked you guys where the blocks had, you wouldn't tell me. I don't need them. Oh, Jesus, that goddamn, they got real excited about that, but there really wasn't too much they could do about it. So this goes to show you what cooperation you can get from those people, see. They found out I was a Tacoma longshoreman. Then they invited me down to have chow with them. Oh, because, you know, Tacoma longshoremen always got around to say, I'll tell you, I said, when I go to eat with you guys, there'll be 9 other guys go to eat with me. And that was the last invite I got down there, but I didn't need it. Anyway, I got quite a boot out of it. Right to start with, you know, we was out at, was in ADAC, and I was on a Liberty, and I just got on it, you know, with my men, and so we hadn't landed at the dock. We had to pick up a certain amount of cargo off of the dock. So, as long as we was out in the stream, I thought, well, I might as well rig the thing, so when we make a landing, why, goddamn, all I have to do is wing out the ear and I'm in business. So I went to the mate and asked him, I says, well, what kind of landing I made? Port starboard, don't make any difference to me. I want to rig this ear. And they were, so he said, I don't know. So they wouldn't even go to find out. So all I did then is I rigged out what the steam schooner style of rigging was. It was wing and wing. It didn't make any difference whether they landed on this side or that side. I'd wing the damn thing out and then wing the other one out, see. So there I was, and it is not they don't have long booms on a Liberty, but I was able to manage to do that. From the time I first got on there, I never got no help out of the mates or the sailors, either one. And yeah. I never forgot that.
During this period with the Army, were you civilian?
No, I was longshore. I was Army.
You were actually Army, but you were doing longshore.
Oh, yeah. I was Army.
Were there many longshoremen who did that?
In our gang, there was one from Seattle, actually one from Superior, Wisconsin, and 2 from Olympia, and myself.
Doing mostly Alaska work, is that?
No. We was out in the islands. We never was in Alaska, so I never was familiar with that. But there was just enough help there so that they was able to, they had a real fine organization. It's probably as good a one as they had in all of the services, all of the services combined.
Mm-hmm. When did people sort of seriously begin considering going into the ILWU? Because I know starting in 38, it would come up all the time, but it was never really taken seriously.
There was always those that were in favor of that. Now you take Ernie Tanner, for an example, and Bob Jensen and so forth. And then there was a lot of them that felt as though a division of the labor movement was only good for one thing, for the employer, which it was. You had to have unity. I don't care. You might not agree with them people 100%, but you had to have the unity. And I always felt that way. And as the time went on, and when the pensions started to become more and more of an issue, then you began to realize that a small organization here could not support a pension plan, whereas a larger group could.
Mm-hmm.
And so that...
Do you think that not being in the ILWU had any effect on the kinds of contracts you were able to get or your working conditions during those years?
Oh, they probably paired one against the other, and you wasn't going to get the best out of theirs, and they wasn't going to get the best out of ours. You know, this is one of those things. Each of you had some good, and each of you had some that you'd like to improve on. But in no case was you going to get the best of the both of them. That mm-hmm. was made.
The employers would see that.
Emphatically clear. And they always, they kept telling us all the time about, oh, such and such a port does this and such a port does that. Well, anyway, one time we took care of that. We had always been told that with our prize 10-man gang here, that and we were discharging ore, that we had more men on the job here and consequently than Portland did, for an example. And Portland, who was our biggest competitor as far as bulk ore was concerned, and Portland was getting all the work. So they finally, I don't know whose idea it was, they finally sent 5 of us down there to take a reading and report back. So we reported into the into the office down at the RLW at Portland in dispatch office and talked with them there and told them what we wanted to do. We didn't want to go down there unannounced, you see, and go down there and start nosing around. We want them people to know what we're down there for. And the purpose of ours was to find out how many men they had. So there happened to be there was ore ships down there. That's the reason we went down there. We went down there, and I would say one of the first things that impressed me was they had a huge blower. Now in our blowers, they generally put a blower on each corner of the hatch, and they're one man can handle them. They're not heavy. I would say they probably weighed 40 pounds at the most. Well, anyway, and you plugged them in and ship juice. Anyway, the first thing I seen here is a huge blower, and this blower here was was an altogether different time. It was a far superior blower to anything they had in the Puget Sound area, far superior. That's the first thing that impressed. The next thing there, and I thought, well, we'll look down the hole and see what's going on down there, and you could have dropped a dime down in the hole there, and you'd still hit somebody down there. That's how many men they had down there. See, they originally had told us up here that all they had was in a four-man gang or something on there. Well, maybe they did, but down there they had far more men than we did. So when we reported back to our organization here and told them, and that was the last time we got any harassment from the employer, which happened to be Grace at that time. And so that was the last time that they reminded us that we were out of step with the rest of the coast. See, mm-hmm. So we caught them in the act, I might as well say. Other times we had been told that Everett, again by the same company, by the same person, let's put it that way, and I won't mention his name because he was a real nice guy, he was a worker, but he used to tell about how they could go up to, how they could take their ship up into Everett up there, and the production up there would run as high as 100 ton an hour. It got way up there, and this was unbelievable. This was absolutely unbelievable. Well, it wasn't 100 ton, but it was probably 60 ton or better. Well, anyway, so once we got the interchange of gangs, and we went up there and found out what the difference was between their pulp and our pulp. Now, our pulp here, the St. Regis pulp, was possibly the most undesirable pulp there was, primarily because it was not uniform in size. You could have two bundles that might weigh the same, and one corner would be 3 or 4 inches higher than another corner. So consequently, you couldn't truck over this. You had to put walking boards down. You get up there in Everett, and all their pulp there was absolutely uniform. You could lay that down. You didn't even need any board. You could run right over the top, but with a two-wheel truck. So consequently, it speeded up the operation. It made it easier for everybody. At the end of a day's time, you could probably stow twice as much pulp per hour as you could here and do it easy, whereas you had to work for it here. And so these are the things, you know. So once the interchange of gangs was consummated and we found out what they did in those other ports, that stopped the rumor mill. And the rumor mill is always going as long as you get two different organizations. Whenever we got into anything where there was any question, I was on the council over there, whenever there's any question about that, I would ask. And I always find out. Kind of interesting.
Now, in the 50s, that you went back to a situation where the council was both ILA and ILWU?
No, that wasn't until we got to the ILWU. But once we had the interchange of games, then we would interchange information.
I see. Okay.
Interchange information, and some of those dyed in the wool AFL men. Of course, they didn't actually want this, and I wouldn't say they threw too many roadblocks in there, but they kind of ridiculed some of the things that had in some of these other ports. But in the long haul, we was in the enviable position of being right square in the middle. As far as the harbor was concerned, as far as Seattle was concerned, or up north, we was in Port Gamble, and we was in a beautiful position here. So the interchange of gangs, it was not the most difficult thing to sell to Tacoma, because Tacoma at that time wasn't doing that much work. It wasn't too prosperous. So anything you got. Now, the first year that we traveled, I made in 6 months' time, I made $1,000 in 6 months' time traveling that 1 year. I don't know what it I don't know what it was for the whole year, but that was a lot of money. See, your wages mm-hmm. then, I don't recall what the wages is. You've got a lot of contracts. You could probably look them up. I will tell you, that was a lot of money then.
Whose idea was the interchange? Did you approach Seattle, or did they approach
no,
you?
No, apparently they made an approach to Tacoma, and Blackie Williams at the time was president. And I was at the meeting, and when he made the selection of men to go, it was his selection. And for some reason or another, I had had no direct communication with him. I hadn't had any contact with him. I knew him as a friend, as a good hatch tender. But as far as being buddy pals, he was with him. He was a nice guy. But no. So anyway, when he announced the five guys that would go there, and then he announced me as chairman. This caught me with my britches down, because this was a surprise. He hadn't told me about it. I hadn't talked with anybody, and nobody had contacted me. And actually, it was one of the best things that ever, it was possibly one of the best things that ever happened on the waterfront. And this was at a time when there was very little work around Tacoma. All the work was in Olympia and Aberdeen, and then there was some work in we did work all over, as a matter of fact, but there was quite a bit of in Seattle. But you see, there we actually went ahead of some of those other ports mm-hmm. because we were strategically located, although sure. we wouldn't necessarily plow them onto all the cream, but we were in a position there. We had everything to gain and nothing to lose.
So you think Seattle did it as a way to try and convince Tacoma to come into the ILWU?
It was probably yes, because that was probably their motive. The main thing was to be sure that when they went on a strike that we didn't work. That was the main thing, because when they had that. What year was it they had that strike there? Was it 49?
After that, one
and,
of the...
That created a lot of hard feelings. And
is that the one where they came down with the planes with the signs behind them and the rowboats?
Yeah. I didn't do very little work. I took off for South Dakota or someplace because I wasn't around very much in that. I never did believe in working under those conditions, because I always mm-hmm. felt as though that... when one is on strike, hey, you better follow, this is no good, us working and they're striking, or vice versa, it'll never be any good. You're pitting one against the other, which is ideal for the employer. All he has to do is pass one rumor around, and by the time it gets down the end of the block there, it's ballooned out of proportion. See, so these are the things. So once we got the interchange going, the rumor miller had to just come pretty close to a stop. Because as you worked in these other ports, you'd talk with the other members in the ILWU. You talked with them. Well, then if you had any doubt about anything, just ask them. That mm-hmm. took care of that.
Mm-hmm. And didn't you lose the interchange for a while before you went in?
No, I don't think we did. I can't recall.
I vaguely remember something. reading something about where you lost it for a while.
I can't recall that, but it could have happened. I won't say that it didn't. I can't recall it. Mm-hmm. But I'd have to look at something to refresh my memory.
In 1956, I found in the files down at the ILWU offices in San Francisco, one of the files, there were a couple of mimeograph sheets that they had gotten, you know, someone had given them or something, that were written in April of 1956. They weren't signed with people's names, called an open letter to Tacoma Longshoremen. It was there were at least two of them that I've seen, in which they were basically trying to convince Tacoma to go independent, to leave the AFL, which the hint was sort of, once we do that, then we should consider going into the ILWU. Now, none of these were signed, and I was wondering if you knew who some of the guys were who were involved in that.
No, I can't. I was never involved in any of the behind-the-scenes thing, although I sympathized with the ILWU. I just am sympathy with them, because we found out after we had went over there a few times that a lot of the stuff we'd heard was a lot of malarkey, you know.
Uh-huh.
And
was this stuff you'd heard from your own leadership?
Oh, yeah. You hear, you know, rumors, you know, stories and so forth that went on, yeah. But that they actually, they were longshoremen just like we were.
Now, I know, I guess Floyd Cox was really opposed to going into the ILWU.
Yeah.
Was that because he was afraid of losing his job as district secretary?
Yeah. He was Floyd Cox always aligned with the sailors, and the sailors had never done nothing to the longshoremen but take away their work after the 34 strike. But he always lined up with the sailors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the guys were becoming increasingly aware that of the work that they were losing as a result of it. Even up in, we had some travelers that come down here, they belong to the AFL, that from Valdez, Alaska. And they up there, when an American ship came in there, the only work they got was on the dock. And this is longshore work. The only work they got was just on the backup men.
Was all. The sailors doing the hatches?
Sailors done all the work. Sailors done all the work. And in fact, is I remember the guy telling me very distinctly that he preferred to see a Canadian ship come in there because at least a Canadian ship they could service the whole thing. So as far as an American ship coming in there, now the Valdez local belonged to the AFL just like the sailors did. But still the sailors didn't think enough of the Valdez longshoremen to give them what they rightfully deserved.
Mm-hmm.
They did not have the only thing they had.
How Bridges is a commie and all that.
Oh, you heard that, yeah, as you heard that, yes.
Did people believe it, or did they?
Oh, it, you're inclined, it just depends. A lot of them were dyed in the wool AFL,
uh-huh.
So consequently they would feel as though he was a communist, I imagine. And of course, anybody that sympathized with him as a communist, I've been calling the next thing. Yes, I've been calling that too. And that was the last thing I ever was. The last thing.
But it was just a technique used to sort of frighten people, or create hostility, maybe, that or something. That.
Yeah, well, it's just an anti-American type of thing. In them days, they were a little bit more patriotic than they are now, and so goddamn, anything wasn't pro-American. Why? But even though the ILWU had put on a scrap iron embargo, you know, during the against the Japanese, you know, refused to do any of their load any of their scrap iron. But that was quite a deal too.
So what were the actual events that led up to taking the vote to go into the ILWU? How did it?
Oh, the. The work opportunity, I would say the work probably had it, and the pension thing. Now, if anybody talked to me, and I never was, I didn't want to split amongst the ranks. That's a tough deal. You just don't, just hate like hell to see that. You just hate, I hate to see that. But the work opportunity and the pension, I felt as though it was a big item.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big item. You see, our pension, they had to cut our pension back and so forth, but even whereas the coast, you could see they just got the people, and we had $1.5 million or whatever it was in our pension fund, which was actually was sufficient, but there was no way we'd ever keep up with like today with our pension today and the widow's pension and all that. There was no way we could do that.
Mm-hmm.
Too small a membership.
Mm-hmm. So what, I know I read some newspaper articles about when the actual vote was taken, and in the newspaper articles, I can't remember who the president of the local was that they quoted at the time, but he sort of refused to give out what the actual vote count was.
Well,
do you have any?
Feely, wasn't he the president?
I don't know. It's either,
I've got it in the files, but
I don't know.
I think it was Ray Feely.
Do either of you remember exactly what the vote was, what the count was?
No.
No, I don't think it was ever published.
Was it a real close vote, or was it pretty overwhelming?
I can't remember that. It was a majority, all right, but I can't recall that. It might be in some of that literature. Did Bill Bridges ever give you some of that stuff that I...
Well, I haven't really been through the files that are down at the office.
I give him all the stuff that I had, and I had a lot of stuff that nobody else had. Mm-hmm. Or a lot of other people didn't have.
Like minutes from area meetings and that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I had, well, actually, I turned them over to the local, but there was other things there, like the names of the guys that were on the area committee and the names of, and on the Puget Sound Council, things like this. Most of that was turned over, but there was a lot of stuff I kept. There was a lot of stuff. I give him an armload of stuff. I had no particular reason to ever get rid of it, and I had the space to keep it, so I kept it. Mm-hmm. But that was it. It was a case of economic salvation, is about that I would have to say. At that time, the very fact that there wasn't enough work around here to our that was prior to Bob Perry's entrance into the picture.
Roy Perry,
the guys was looking to the future. They could see this travel. If you didn't want to travel, this was fine and dandy, because there was other guys that would travel. That means it would give you more of an opportunity to stay in here. See, it was beautiful all the way around, and I don't think there was. I think most everybody traveled, although I'm sure there had to be exceptions to that. But that was good money. That was real good money, traveling, the lodging, and so forth. And speaking of lodging, I have to tell you this again. They had a rate, a special rate for the rooms and so forth, which I don't recall. But Frank Andrews, who was a regional representative for the Isle de Vie from Olympia down there, I never will forget the time that he went to, we had a meeting with Cornell. And he'd found out that the supercargoes were getting more money per diem. They were getting more trout, more everything than a longshoremaner. Well, Frank Andrews, he put a squelch to that real quick. He stopped it instantly. There was a hotel down in Aberdeen there where the supercargo stayed, and the longshoremen stayed in the same hotel. I don't recall the name of the hotel. But anyway, Frank Andrews kept track of the meals. He kept track of everything, and he found out these supercargoes was eating the same meals as he was and staying in the same rooms as he was. So when he took that back, he says, "Hey, how come these guys are entitled to so much and we're only entitled to so much? We're just as good as they are, and we're spending just as much as they are, and they ain't spending any more than we are." So we got that just right now. That was, at the drop of a hat, that was one of the shrewdest things I ever heard of in my life. That was real smart, but he had kept the record track.
Yeah. Well, good records are hard to refute if you've got it written down.
There was no argument at all. No argument at all. We immediately got that additional benefit. That was cute. Oh, I got to tell you one here. On the area, when I was on the area...
Do you always tell stories like this? Is that...
I never will forget, on the area, Fred Smith, he was the representative for Seattle Stevedore, and I think Tom Green. Yeah, I'm sure Tom Green was for Rothschild. Well, anyway, we had a beef up there, and the two of them did not get along too well. And outwardly, at a meeting like that, of course, they couldn't show too much animosity. But this particular time, Fred Smith, I could see he was leaning towards us, see, so, man, we was giving everything we could, you know, all the arguments we could, and we could see that, and they finally decided that, my gosh, this was a legitimate beef, my gosh, and Fred Smith all the time thought that this was a case where Rothschild hadn't paid what they should have paid, you know, according to the contract, and so Fred, he was pretty happy. He was pretty happy that he found out instead of Rothschild, it was Seattle Steve.
He just voted against himself.
Yeah, we had all kinds of beef. The ones you thought you could win easy, you could, or sometimes hard. You know, hard wins.
Did you often have these situations where the employer representatives were sort of, they were very conscious of the competition between themselves as employers, and they would play off longshoremen to try and take advantage?
Not too much, because Cornell seemed to that.
Mm-hmm.
He seemed to it that, hey, you belong to this side of the fence. You know, yeah, you could see that. But I imagine you could probably depend on one or the other under certain situations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't quite know.
Well, I've got my research assistants coming in pretty soon for our meeting. Is there anything else that you wanted to get on, or?
If anything right now.
Have you got all the contracts? I've got one book in my car left of all of those, and that's a 47 contract. Do you have that?
I don't. After about, let's see. I've got almost every contract up to 1940, and after that, it's real spotty. I have others. And
I had all. I give all of them to Bill Bridges, and I would say they're all there. But I've got that one out in my car. It's a 47.
Yeah. Well, I'll have to. I mean, I have to go up to the office eventually anyway, and go through and just sort of check what's there and I'm not going to be able to go through all their files because it would just take forever to sort through every little piece of paper. But as I have questions, I'll be going up, you know, to find certain things. And I think when we get all of this material collected to put in a library or something, we'll try to get copies of, you know, every contract. And
there was a whole bunch of them there, and I give all that stuff to Bill. There's a lot of that. A lot of that stuff had to do with Harry and this year.
Mm-hmm.
And this was at a time, you know, this was at a bum time. This was on that mechanization type of thing, you know, performance, which was it.
Did the M&M agreement ease that situation? Did it?
No, it was, it just finally, I guess both parties had to decide, hell, this is getting us no place, because it was friction. You never knew where you was going or how long you was going to stay there after you got there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it did break down a lot of conditions.
Some of the conditions that the guys always raved about so much actually weren't that big of an issue, you know, when it got right down to it. Because you can't justify a place where you're not using it, you know. And this is what they were trying to prove. Hey, we got 8 men here, but only 2 of them working or something on this. Or, you know, this is hard to justify. There ain't no way you can do that. But, it was a changing time, and it come on real abrupt. That was they should have taken a piecemeal, then they could have been able to sell it a lot easier. But they give it to you all at once, and perhaps that was the best, but I don't know.
Well, look at the hard feeling it created when you turned around and the guys that were coming up for retirement after the M&M, they got hot under the collar because they weren't getting the money after Bridges stood up on that podium and told us it was going to be unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
As the years went by.
Mm-hmm.
And to chop it off that abruptly, it created a heck of a lot of hard feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's 13.6 was a lot of money in them days. The equivalent would be now about 36,000 something on that, or 40,000 in that area, you know, with the inflation and everything. But and to me, of all the things they've got, the worst one is the women's pension. That had to be the stupidest one I've ever heard of. I tell you, primarily because. A woman only had to be, she had no age limit, you understand. I am emphasizing this, there's no age limit on this woman, whereas this isn't a man. A man, he has to be 62 or something. A woman, she could be 20 years old and collect that. And believe me, there was a longshoreman, old man Jones, for an example. He was in his 80s and he had a 16-year-old girl. And unfortunately, they finally had a separation. She couldn't keep up with him. But had she been alive, can you imagine? We'd have been paying her, for Christ's sake, into the next century.
This was like a widow's pension?
Yeah, yeah, this is the pension. Now, you see, they put an age limit on men, mm-hmm. but never on women. Only stipulation was that they had to be married 5 years. But if she was married 5 years, and then he kicks the bucket, then she collects. You see, she could collect that. She could be 20 years of age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that only came in after 65.
I understand when it come in. I understand when it come in. But and now they dropped that from 5 years. They dropped it down to
3 years.
And I said at the time, I says, and of course, that she'd keep that pension as long as she lived, or until she remarried. Well, you show me a woman that remarries and loses that pension, and I'll show you a first-class idiot. It's that simple. And I wrote down there. I put a manuscript down. I still got a lot of the stuff at home. I wrote a manuscript down there to Frisco and told him what I thought of that arrangement. It was a fall ball arrangement, if there ever was one. But I told him, I says, God, I says, they was getting into Pandora's box. They didn't realize what they was getting into when they started this widow's pension. Primarily, some of them were self-employed. Some of them were working. Some of them were making more money than the longshoremen. So that normally they're 7 years younger than the man. That's the way it used to be. I don't know what it is now, but I think it was 7 years younger. See, so. Anyway, here you could be paying a woman a pension and she could still be working. Mm-hmm. Well, this is impossible, you know, whereas the longshoreman himself couldn't. Now, you could pay a woman, I could say now Jones's wife there, you could conceivably be paying her 70 years. Mm-hmm. Imagine 70 years, it'd probably run into the millions.
Is there, besides the wife, is there a dependence, like for children?
Yes, minor children.
Medical.
Yeah.
Medical.
Yeah. And
the Social Security takes care of the minor children. Yeah. They get their medical after 65. That's why, I just got through researching some of the widows. Remember old Fawcett?
Yeah, Beaky Fawcett.
No, I don't, Edgar Fawcett. Is that Beaky?
Yeah.
Well, his widow's still alive. Yeah. And then there, did you know that Cowles?
Yeah.
Well, his widow's still alive. Yeah. She was born in 92. Fawcett's wife was born in 94.
88 and 86. You understand me, I don't object to a genuine housewife. Mm-hmm. But one that ain't a genuine. This is where I object. I object to that.
So you would rather see the widow's pension only for those women who aren't working?
No, that can't be totally done. Constitutionally wise, that can't be done. You see, you can't separate one from the other.
Right.
So, I would say this, do just like every other legitimate organization does. Now, the laborers up there, what they do is, we'll say that they have a $500 a month pension. But if you want to divvy that up with your wife, that's fine and dandy. Then you take whatever you want to take, the proportions. Then they add 10% or something like that to the man. So, in other words, if you wanted to take $250, and then when you kick the bucket, your wife gets $250, you can do that. This is fine, but you only get $500. What they're doing here now is you got $500, and then they got $250. See, which is $750. Constitutionally wise, they'll murder him in a court of law on a goddamn deal like that, because this gives more benefit to a guy that's married. But and this is what I was trying to tell. Would you believe I'm the only one up in that organization that thought that way when it mm-hmm. first started? I'm the only one. I couldn't get anybody to sympathize with me. Mm-hmm. See, and I went to the laborers up there. And they asked me, oh, that's before they even had one, they asked me how our system worked. And I told them, well, actually, this was after their system had started. And when I told them how ours worked, Jesus, man, they said, well, you're crazy. See, and even the woman working in the office overheard the conversation. She came in, she says, oh, she says, our system here, the way it is here, we don't even recommend it. But she says, there's only one person that ever did. Only one man ever took care of his wife. He just took half the pension when he died, and she got the other half. But, well, if you happen to kick the bucket first, that's it. Or she kicks the bucket, rather. If she dies first, that's it. You still get your 250 the rest of your life. You know, this is the way that works. But this is a real, it's a bum deal any way you want to look at it. This is a real bum deal. We've got women up there that are making far more than the men were here, and still working. And can you imagine us paying them a pension while they're still working? They'll be getting more pensions than we will. They'll be getting Social Security, government pension, and then our pension. Now, this is an absolute waste of money. You know, we're not a welfare outfit, but from the looks of that deal, we are. Now, one of the arguments that I used, again, was in about 1960 or later. Is that at that time there was, you wouldn't believe the war was over. It was in 61. The Civil War was over 106 years. And do you know how many widows pensioned, how many widows were still on pension? 423. And of those 423, the youngest one was 57 years of age. She could conceivably be collecting that thing until the next century. Mm-hmm. And the war is over. The war would have been over 150 years, and we're paying the Civil War widow's pension. See how ridiculous that is? Now, this Uncle Sam got into that. That just goes to show you. You know, when you have not an age limit, you've got an age limit on men, you haven't got one on women. Mm-hmm. See? This is
Okay, thanks, Frank.
I got to go to that funeral.
Right.
I got to go out there with the dryer.
I'll be sure they don't put the wrong one away.
Oh, sure.
You coming to meeting tomorrow?
I may and I may not. I'm a busy man.
Dizzy.
to me was, and I've talked to all kinds of guys. I've talked with Walt Jugum over in Seattle over there, and I, at that time, had all the statistics on how long women were, the longevity of women after a certain age, you know. This actuary report starts at depending on how old you are, whether you're 20 years old from birth, 60, 65. And I had all the dope, and I was talking to Jugum, and old Jugum told me himself, he says, "God damn, rightfully, you're the only one that ever showed me them figures." And he says, "I know you're right, but," he says, "you'll never sell the program." Mm-hmm. "You'll never sell it, but I don't care who I talk to. I've talked to a friend of mine's wife and him, it's been about 3 weeks ago, and they ain't been up to see me since, and I don't know if they will or not, because she was mad. See, she feels as though she's bitten gypped. I couldn't explain to her, hey, you ain't getting gypped at all, you're just getting more than you're entitled to, right, to start with." A lot of them, I've asked them, how about before this widows come along here, how much insurance did you guys have on your wives? 99 chance out of 100, they thought so much of their women, but they still didn't have a nickel's worth of insurance. They want somebody else to take care of them. They wouldn't take care of them themselves. They'd rather go out and have, buy their wine or what have you, but as far as them taking care of the wives, they want somebody else to do it, you understand? Mm-hmm. See? Mm-hmm. And one guy even told me, he said, "My wife has stayed by me through thick and thin." He says, "all these strikes." I said, "Oh, for Christ's sake, shut up." I says, "You've only been in one strike." "No, you haven't even been in any strike that I know of since you've been on this goddamn waterfront. And your wife, as far as sticking by you, she's just like them goddamn Civil War widows. Now, I suppose you're going to tell me now that they were stood by their men there and listened to the clarion call of the bugle there at Bull Run and Gettysburg. I'll tell you bullshit, which it is." Mm-hmm. See, the women didn't help the men on the picket line at all. They didn't help them any place. My women would have taken care of me if I was a garbage collector. The fact that I was a longshoreman didn't enter into it. You see what I'm getting at? Mm-hmm. This is my viewpoint on that. But I was probably more aggravated than anything on that age limit. That really irritated me, where a woman could collect more money, and she'd only been married to a guy 5 years than a guy that had been there 18 years on the waterfront. Now, this had to be something radically wrong. Mm-hmm. Well, other solution is to do like they do in Canada, or do like the laborers, any of the rest of these progressive outfits do. Hey, everybody's got one share. But under our system now, it's a share and a half. When you die, your widow gets half. But a single man, he only has that one share. You see what's wrong about that? You follow me?
Yeah, I follow you.
You see what's wrong. And I'm not being, I'm not anti-woman, you understand? I'm just good, plain common sense. Hey, everybody get treated the same. In our organization or any other, if you got an organization, everybody gets treated the same. But in this situation, they're not treated the same.
Mm-hmm.